picked as his discourse for this afternoon, Paul's Pricks. Paul's Pricks, Brother Carl.
Well, brethren, we enjoyed very much being here last year, and we're glad that we can be back again in your midst. We do bring you the love and greetings of the Chicago Ecclesia. We had hoped that there would have been 4 or 5 of us coming. We had planned that way, but at the last minute it didn't work out. So I bring you the love of those who had planned to be here. My daughter Sherelle, my wife Marge, Sister Renata Regala, and Sister Ella Yakosh, who had planned to be also at this convention. They send their love. You may recognize our title, Paul's Pricks, from a statement that was made to Paul by the Lord Jesus on the way to Damascus. Paul repeats the statement in Acts 26 chapter and the 14th verse. He's talking about his own conversion. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking to me and saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. The illustration that is being used, I think we all recognize, is that of an ox goad. That's the kind of prick that he's mentioning, where if you're driving an ox in a certain way, you have a stick with a sharp point at the end, and you can, if it starts kicking back and you put it behind it, it will soon move forward because it will be prodded onward. They are the various prods of conscience that are there to direct along the way. Paul, of course, at this time, point of time, was a persecutor of the brethren. He was one who, out of all sincerity, feeling he must quell the new faith that was rising in Israel, had taken to very violently and very physically persecuting the church throughout the area. In fact, that was the purpose of his journey to Damascus, was to carry on the persecution in that area. And when the Lord talked to him, he said, Paul, you may think you're doing this out of a good conscience, but you're not. You've got certain pricks. Your conscience is pricking you. Your conscience is bothering you doing the very thing that you are doing. The extent of our discussion today, this afternoon, is to try to examine what some of these pricks of conscience were that affected the Apostle Paul. As we look at the Apostle Paul and his conscience, I would like us in our minds to broaden the subject. To broaden it to realize that perhaps there are times when you and I also, out of the best of motivations, perhaps may be persecutors of the brethren. And if we ever are, to realize that there are pricks of conscience that will affect us as well. Or perhaps there are times where we may feel persecuted by others or see others persecuting. How can we be pricks to their conscience? But we're going to look primarily at Paul. A person's conscience is the best guide that a person has to the course of conduct to make. But conscience is not always a reliable indicator. Conscience, too, needs education. Conscience needs instruction. Conscience is based upon, as the word itself suggests, knowledge, science, cone science, with knowledge. That knowledge that we build into our background. Conscience is our reaction to what we are as a person at a given point in time, and how the actions that we do reflect with our inner feelings and our inner identification with ourselves as a person. What made Paul what Paul was at the early stages of his life? We don't have a lot of background information upon the youth and the education of Paul. But we do have some scripture indications along the line that we're going to look at. And we're going to notice just 4 lessons today. Just 4 individual pricks that the scriptures may indicate were part of Paul's background. One of the things we do know about Paul is that he was a very thoroughly trained and educated young man. We read about this in Acts, the 22nd chapter and the 3rd verse, where Paul says, "I am verily a man which am a Jew, born in Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, yet brought up in this city, Jerusalem, at the feet of Gamaliel, and taught according to the perfect manner of the law of the fathers, and was zealous toward God, as ye are all this day." In the Jewish sense of the term, Paul was a lawyer. In the Jewish sense of the term, he was one who had been extremely versed in the Jewish law, the law of Moses. Not only in the letters of that law, but in the rabbinical translations and traditions associated with that law, with the extensions of that law. He had as his teacher the most prominent Jewish scholar of his day. Even today, as Jews look back upon their history, they select as one of the most outstanding scholars of all times the great Hillel. Hillel was the grandfather of Gamaliel. This Gamaliel has one of the richest traditions in Jewish history for knowledge of Jewish law. Gamaliel was not only a practitioner of law, but he took with it that uncommon element called common sense. He had the ability to be patient in the application of law. That's shown in Acts, the 5th chapter, verse 34, where we get a little insight into Gamaliel and how he viewed law. This was in one of the earlier situations with Peter. We start in verse 34 of Acts 5. "Then stood there up one in the council, a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a doctor of the law, had in reputation among all the people, and commanded to put the apostles forth a little space. And he said to them, You men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you intend to do with touching these men. For before these days rose up Thutis, boasting himself to be somebody, to whom a number of men, about 400, joined themselves, and he was slain. And all as many as obeyed him were scattered and brought to naught. And after him rose up Judas of Galilee in the days of the taxing, and he drew away many people after him, and he also perished. And all, even as many as obeyed him, were dispersed. And now I say to you, refrain from these men, let them alone. For if this counsel or this work be of men, it will come to naught. But it be of God, ye cannot overthrow it, lest haply ye be found even to fight against God." Gamaliel had the common sense to know that the author of the law of Israel was by far the best interpreter of that law. And therefore, in a situation where there was doubt, let the situation work itself out. If it was of God, no man could stop it. And if it was men, no man need to stop it, because it would falter of itself. Paul, as he went forth, of course, went forth to study the Ark of God, to stop this heresy that he saw arising, and that in itself perhaps began to prick his conscience. Under Gamaliel, Paul would have learned the fine details of Jewish law. And it's ironic that we best see these details exhibited in the Scriptures out of a Roman, one of those who, in Paul's later life, became Paul's own judge, the Roman counselor, Festus. We have the account of Paul before Festus in the 25th chapter of Acts. And in the trial of Paul before Festus, two great principles of law are enunciated. Two principles that were extremely vital to Roman law, two principles that are basic to modern American law, two principles that were very definitely reflective of Mosaic law of Israel, two principles that are exhibited by Jesus Christ in the law of the Christian in his dealing with one another. The first of these principles is enunciated in Acts 25, verse 16. Festus is speaking, and he is answering how he is going to hold the trial of Paul. He said, "I answered, it is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer to him for himself concerning the crime laid against him. A very basic principle of law. In a courtroom today, it is insisted that the accused be there, and the ones who are his accusers be there face to face, not only so they can accuse him to his face, but so that he can cross-examine. He can come back, and there can be a fair examination of the trial. It's interesting that recently this has come very much in the news with the trial of Klaus Barbie in Lyon, France, where Barbie has refused to be present at his own trial. This principle goes back way to biblical times, that the accuser shall be at his trial, and the accused both. That's a principle that Jesus recognizes in Matthew 18, when he lays down the counsel of how to handle disputes amongst yourselves. He says, if you have aught against your brother, go to him. Let the accuser face the accused. And if that doesn't work, send somebody else. No, it doesn't say that. Go with somebody else. Always let the accuser and the accused be there face to face. Let there be a chance for a full discussion of the subject. But Paul, in the ardor of his youth, in trying to squelch this heresy of Christianity that was arising in Judaism, ignored this principle. When he went persecuting the Christians, he was not bringing them up for a court trial, but was persecuting them out of hand at the time. Would this not have had to prick his conscience? He was trained in what law should be. Gamaliel had taught him the moderate use of law. And despite that, he was violating that principle of law. And while he felt that there was an overpowering rule and reason why he must persecute, I dare say it was one of the pricks that was there to guide him in the proper way he kicked against. Same thing is so evidently true at times with us, where we may feel that there's some great heresy of fact or of doctrine that we feel we must squelch. Do we see that the accuser and the accused face each other? Do we see there's an honest examination of the issue, or is it judged out of hand? If it is ever not judged, other than with the full right of the accused to face the accuser, then there must be a prick of conscience. There must be that which bothers, as not a full law of justice implied. In the same 25th chapter of Acts, there is a second principle of law that Festus enumerates. Another principle of law that in the trial of Paul was extremely hard for Festus to implement. In fact, it puzzled him. He was left without an answer. It's found in Acts 25:27. It seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Such a basic principle. How can you send somebody to trial without specifying what he's being tried for? Put yourself in poor Festus' position, though. He had a problem. Paul was brought before the court of Festus by the Jews. The accusation against him was clearly spelled out. He had brought into the temple three Greeks. Paul refused to answer the charge. Paul says, I'm brought here because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. He relates an answer totally irrelevant to the crime, because Paul is recognizing that the crime against him was strictly a religious crime. And so he said, let's go down to the root, what the religious problem is. We have a dispute amongst yourselves. And he was capitalizing on that dispute. Festus, as a Roman, didn't know what they're talking about. So he calls in all fairness, King Agrippa, who, being familiar with Judaism, should know the problems of Jews. And he has Agrippa conduct a secondary examination in front of him so he can better understand the charges. At the conclusion of which, Paul repeats, I appeal to Rome. Paul says, I refuse to be tried here formally. I'm a Roman citizen. I've got the right to be tried in Rome. But Festus says, how can I send this man to Rome? I've got no crime. The only crime I've got is a religious crime, which Rome doesn't recognize. So I can't send him to Rome on a crime of believing the resurrection of the dead. I can't even send him to Rome on the crime of having three Gentiles, if there were three Gentiles in the temple. That's no crime in Rome. I have no crime to specify. He was caught in a corner. He was not able to specify the charge against Paul, and yet Paul had forced his hand. He said, I demand to go to Rome. And there was nothing that he could legitimately send him to Rome to be tried upon. But there's a principle of law. And that principle of law is there must be a clear understanding not only of what the person has done wrong, but of why it's a crime. What makes it wrong? That element that makes the crime the crime. In our course, we do it by citing chapter and verse. You have violated chapter and verse of the civil code or whatever code is involved. There is a clear specification of the charges. Paul, when he was persecuting the Christians, knew that this was a part of all legal systems. Again, it was certainly a part of the Jewish legal system, because again, this is what Matthew 18 is all about. It is comprehending the crime. Before you make the judgment, be sure you understand it. In the Proverbs, it says, he who judges the matter before he heareth it is folly unto him. There is no comprehension of the exact nature of the crime. Paul's accusation of the Christian crime was, this is uncomfortable to Judaism. This gives Judaism a great problem. This is heretical. But it was no more heretical to Paul, a Pharisee, than was the Sadducee crime of non-belief at all, of non-belief in the resurrection of the dead. That was equally heretical. And yet Paul was not specifying that was a crime. But this Christian heresy, which was a fundamentalist belief in Judaism, a strong religious faith, but a different religious faith than that which was enunciated by the Pharisee community, was nothing that Paul could specify. He had to persecute out of emotionalism, out of fear, rather than out of a logical specification of the crime. That had to prick Paul's conscience. It was against all of his legal training. It was against what Paul was trained to be. And if we should ever find ourselves in the position of out of fear, out of emotionalism, harassing another of our brothers, it should be a prick to our conscience. It is against the whole concept of Matthew 18. Let's go on to a third prick of Paul's conscience. Got a trivia question for you. How many of Paul's cousins can you name? Don't hear too much. Well, I'll name three of them for you. We're going to talk about two. Herodion, Junia, and Andronicus. We're going to talk about Junia and Andronicus. You meet them in Romans, the 16th chapter. And you find out an unusual thing about these two cousins of Paul. Whether they were cousins or some other relative, that is not specified. It's specified, the word is that for a close kinsman. Romans 16, I've got to find Romans, that should be easy. Romans 16, verse 7. Salute Andronicus and Junia, my kinsmen. And the word there means that of a fairly close family relationship. My fellow prisoners, who are of note among the apostles, who were in Christ before me. Notice that. Paul was not the first Christian in his family. There were two other Christians within the family relationship of Paul, Andronicus and Junia. And we don't know much about Andronicus or Junia, other than this one simple fact, that they were Christians who predated Paul. Put yourself in Paul's shoes. The very greeting here suggests that these were ones he cares about. And I think you care about your cousins and your relatives. It's one thing to go out there and persecute a nameless enemy, somebody you haven't met, somebody who's irritated you. But if every time you do it, you realize, someday, I've got to do the same thing to Andronicus and Junia. My own cousins are involved. That it gets right down into your own family. I think that was a prick to Paul's conscience. The realization that within his family, there were members who were taken up with his heresy. Members who did nothing more wrong than disagree with him. Members who, like They said of Daniel, we can find nothing against this man except to be his religion. This was the sole thing he had against them. That had to be one of the things that bothered Paul as he was going and realizing how close this would come to home. It shows the privilege we have of being sure that we witness to our family and that we do it in such a way that our life is the main witness and our words are the secondary witness. So that what they have against us is not our manner of life. They may not approve, but they must admire his dedication, that it is holy, that it is pure, that it is dedicated, that it is given fully to a cause. But at the same time, they may not agree with our words. That that be a prick on their conscience, in their opposition. And our realization that we too, in many cases, especially in a movement that's gone this long, have many relatives of many different geographical and ideological areas. That everything we are looking at affects one another as part of a literal family as well as a spiritual family. I'm sure that was a prick to Paul's conscience. Another trivia question. Who was Paul's mother? We meet her in Romans 16 too. Romans 16, this time verse 13. Salute Rufus, chosen of the Lord, his mother and mine. Paul says that Rufus' mother was his mother. I like the New American Standard Version here. I think it covers the point. Salute Rufus and his mother, who has been just like a mother to me. I'm sure that's the point. Not that Rufus' mother was literally Paul's mother, but that Rufus' mother was in a spiritual position of a mother to him. She had been one he looked to not just as a sister in Christ, but as a mother in Israel, in spiritual Israel. There's a lot of lessons from that. One of the first lessons that grabs me, even apostles need mothers. You know, sometimes you see a person who's got great prominence, maybe a position, you say, oh, that person is so independent. Admire his independence. Don't kid yourselves. They've got the same needs everyone else has got. They have the same needs to have a friend, to share, to tell it. I have been at elders' meetings in my life where I've seen elders literally break down and cry for lack of somebody to talk to. And that does exist, where somebody needs somebody to share with, this ability to communicate one to another. Which of us, looking back in our Christian life, cannot point to half a dozen or more who at one time or another did that little extra mile that just touched us and moved us in the right direction? Our own spiritual parents. I'm just going to give a few testimonies here just about my own life, because I think that as I look back at my personal life and some who have been spiritually helpful to me, they illustrate principles of how we can be spiritual mothers, spiritual brothers, spiritual sisters one to another. As probably most of you know, I was born and raised in isolation from the brethren. I was born and raised in a little town in Iowa. Just my father and myself. The closest meeting we had, got to it one time a year, and that one time was very special, was the Labor Day conventions in Minneapolis. And I grew up as a kid going there, so as a kid, you know how kids are at meetings. They go there because they got no other choice. That's where daddy is, and that's where you're going to be too. You know, you're going to go because that's where you're told to go. Fortunately, I had a little buddy my age, Mike Nakora, and we used to get in a lot of trouble together. But despite that, I guess I shouldn't tell him, Michael. But I wasn't all that interested. I was just a kid. But one convention, lunch hour came around, and I was probably about 9 years old. And I was sitting on the side. Michael had to do some duty, so I couldn't play with him. And I was bored as all get out, wondering why I had to be there. And one of the speakers came, and he sat next to this young boy, and he said, Carl, what do you think about Gideon? And I said, who's Gideon? Never heard of the guy. So he began explaining who Gideon was and going to the story. He said, what do you think about the story? And he got my mind first activated. It's where my mind first began thinking that the Bible was interesting. And I guess Brother Leo Post, I always appreciate that, that you took the time to sit with a little boy back in those years. How often do we see little boys sitting around? Maybe we miss them. Maybe we don't aren't that spiritual father or spiritual mother to them. Then, a few years later, we got to our first general convention. I was now about 11. And a sister came along, and all along the way, she saw that I had fairly decent memory, so she started working the memory, getting me to memorize manna texts, and got me to the convention, started challenging me to say, I bet I can sit in more meetings you can sit in, and bet I can take more notes you can take in. That was a way to help a younger one in Christ. And Mary Sue, thank you very much. Mary Sue Guzik from this class was one of my spiritual mothers at that time. And I can just go on and enumerate half a dozen, because we each have those in our life, where we have that certain area along the line. These are very important areas, a very important function in our own Christian life. I know when I finally got of age, finished school, went to the dawn to work, teenager at the time, you know, teenagers got big problems. They discover that girls are different than boys. And that's a big problem in itself. You know, and you start having certain relationships, and they don't always work out the way you think they're going to work out. And I tell you, that age, nothing can set you down more than that. And there was a sister who'd always take me for a walk and get my head straightened out. Carmela Luke is that sister, and she's here today too, I think. Just as you go over it, I'm just looking at today's audience to see some of those who have helped me at various parts in my Christian life. These are important one to another. And so Paul had his mother. Paul had his mother, and she happened to be the literal mother of Rufus. Paul had children too, you know. Timothy was his child, my son Timothy. And when you think of that relationship, you think particularly of the beginning of your Christian life. Oh, not that we don't have mothers all down through, but you think particularly of some experience at the beginning of the Christian life. So let's ask the question further. Who was Paul's mother? The clue we got in Romans is that she was the mother of Rufus. So all we need to find out now is who was Rufus' mother. And then we know who Paul's mother is. And that's easy. The Bible tells us who Rufus' mother was. It's in Mark. The Gospel of Mark, the 15th chapter. On the last day of the life of Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus had been tried before Pilate, been sentenced to death. He's carrying the cross on the way to the hill of Calvary. Mark 15:21 says, "And they compel one Simon, a Cyrenian, who passed by, coming out of the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to bear the cross." Paul's mother was the wife of Simon the Cyrenian. Notice the way history turns. Here was a person probably picked by chance out of that crowd. The effect of the service he did for the Lord was not only to provide Christianity as a whole, probably for himself, he's probably dead by the time Paul writes Romans, but to his wife, to at least one of the sons. Doesn't mean that Alexander wasn't also a Christian. He may not have gone to Rome. You've got a tale of three continents here. You've got a family that was in Cyrenia. Jesus meets them in Asia, and now Paul writes to them in Europe, in Rome. There was mobility in that early Christian church as well. They moved around. Here was this Cyrenian woman who was Paul's mother. Where did they meet? How did he get to know her? This Paul was from Tarsus. Paul wasn't from Africa. Where would they meet? Well, I don't know. I'm just going to suggest where they met. Brother Dyfer was quoted earlier today, and he said one expression he used to love. He said, "You should have two pockets, your facts in one and your opinions in the other." And he said, "The wisdom's on which is which." Well, I'm going to reach in the opinion pocket. I'm going to reach into the opinion pocket and try to create a scenario for where I think Paul met his spiritual mother. We do think of meeting your spiritual mother at the beginning. Right at the beginning. That's which really gets things started in your mind, which really starts the spiritual juices flowing. Where do we first meet Paul? Well, I think we all know where we meet him. We meet him on that reference that Steve quoted earlier, where he was holding the coats for those who were persecuting Stephen. Remember, that's the first time we come across him. Where did that happen? Jerusalem, of course. Where? Where in Jerusalem did this incident take place where we find the meeting of Paul and this trial that results in the death of Stephen? The specific location is given in Acts 6, verse 9. Then there arose certain of the synagogue, which is called the synagogue of the Libertines and Cyrenians and Alexandrians, and of them a Cilician of Asia, disputing with Stephen. The dispute took place at the Cyrenian synagogue. That was a synagogue where some of Cyrenia, some of Cilicia, some of Alexandria were meeting. These were Jews who were from these other countries who now were living in Jerusalem. And it's at this synagogue where we first meet Paul. And that was a very emotional day, you recall. There was a big argument as to the teachings of Stephen. And Paul, some say he was in the Sanhedrin, I would dispute that. I would say that Paul, more probably, as a disciple of Gamaliel, and Gamaliel, who was in the Sanhedrin, was there as, we would call him sanctity, a page boy. He was there as a student, one who was studying under one of those in the Sanhedrin. There are reasons to question whether Paul ever was himself a member of the Sanhedrin. But he was in close association. And as he heard this dispute, he could not help but agree with the emotion that carried along that found against Stephen, and says Paul consented to the death in both accounts. But I can't help but imagine, after I look at Romans, of thinking, you know, for a dispute, there has to be two sides present. You don't have a dispute with everybody on one side. So if Stephen is arguing, I just think there was a little lady there at that synagogue. May not have said much, but left an indelible impression on Paul's face. The wife of Simon the Cyrenian. That all along later, as he went along, as he persecuted those Christians, there was that nagging prick of that face that he had seen that very first time that we met him. It shows the value to me of the witness of a proper spirit. The witness that we can give, maybe not through any words we say, maybe only through the spirit that we show. The silent acceptance of wrong. The ability to be sweet in the face of that which is not sweet coming our direction. The ability to lay down and, as Jeremiah says in Lamentations, eat dust. If so be, there might be hope. And I think that that was one of the greatest pricks to the conscience of Paul. That later, when he came to realize on the Damascus Road that he was the one who had been wrong, that he looked back and says, that's where my spiritual life began. When I saw that calm, that sweet face of that Cyrenian sister. That's something we can do to one another. If attacked, lie down. Take it. Be sweet. Have the sweet return. And never, as Paul himself said, give evil for evil, but render good for evil, thereby heaping coals of fire upon their heads. What a lesson Paul's mother might give to us if we think of that type of spirit that would have put her in that position. And what an honor to her husband for being willing to bear that cross and not only provide the beautiful privilege of being a Christian himself, but of providing a mother for one who has been a father to all of us, the Apostle Paul. So, brethren, as we look to some of the pricks of Paul's conscience, may it help us appreciate Paul more. May it also be an incentive to us to keep our consciences tuned very carefully to the Lord and His will, and to take our opportunities of being a witness by our words or by our smiles to one another, so that we too can prick one another to provoke one another unto love and unto good works.